Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
American Rivers just released a comprehensive report on America's 10 most endangered rivers. And they're challenging the government's leading river management agency to take a serious look at how their policies are creating a backwash of disasters because of backward practices that demand to be considered. From Oregon to Texas, Florida to Michigan, there's a good chance at least one of these rivers is flowing in your own backyard. Find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News. I think we're beginning to grow up as a nation. We as a people are maturing to the point that we're beginning to find a need to take steps on our own behalf, stand up to outdated authority, and take a stand for wisdom and a better way. It's a message that is being felt around the world these days as people and the governments grapple with the daunting forces of nature. As our first global show continues, we invite all of our listeners around the world to pay attention, because all of us share the same breath, drink the same waters, rely on the same sun, and most amazingly, share our common voice now here on the Wildside News. We're hearing so many different things about weather these days. Storms, floods, dust storms, sandstorms, rivers flooding, tornadoes, hurricanes. Weather is in the news. And weather has its bad side, but it also has its good side. It keeps us nourished with plenty of water, or hopefully it does. And it has many different aspects for us. It's critical to survival for all living things on the earth. And so the issue of, in particular, weather and water and rivers and lakes and streams is extremely important. And it's becoming the focus of an annual report by American Rivers, who each year put on a list of their 10 most endangered rivers. And joining us to talk about this year's report, which has just been released and is available on their website, is Melissa Samet. She's the Senior Director of Water Resources with American Rivers. Melissa, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thanks so much for having me.
Melissa, each year you put on a new list of endangered rivers, the American Rivers does. And this year is no exception. You have a unique focus this year, and we're going to cover all of that. First of all, give us a little history on American Rivers.
American Rivers was established back in the 1970s and has as its focus exclusively working to protect and restore rivers nationwide. We have offices across the country. We have about 50 employees, and as I said, we focus exclusively on river issues. We've done a lot of hydropower reform work. I work particularly with trying to change the practices of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We focus on restoration efforts. We have a program that removes dams that are no longer make sense. And so we really focus on rivers and rivers across the country. And our Most Endangered Rivers report is our yearly opportunity to highlight rivers that are actually facing a critical policy decision point in the coming year. So it's really designed to help focus people's attention to those rivers that are reaching an important turning point and rivers where the public can weigh in to make a difference.
And so what you're really trying to do is draw attention to rivers that with some changes, with attention, actually changes could happen that could result in positive change if we act.
That's right, and negative change, unfortunately, if we don't act.
That's exactly right. That's why it's critical. Well, this year you're focusing on the Corps of Engineers. I'm very familiar with the Corps of Engineers. At one point, I did a project for them up in the Dakotas on the Souris River, where the Souris River would flood every year, and Minot would get flooded, and my job was to go in and does a special project, and it was interesting. But I think a lot of people aren't familiar with really what the Corps of Engineers does. It sounds kind of interesting. It sounds like a kind of romantic, the Corps of Engineers. And they've been in place for a very long time and have had critical influence on watersheds and rivers. Give us a sense of why you're focusing right now on the Corps' work as it relates to rivers.
Well, the Corps has, as you said, been around for a very long time, from the Revolutionary War. But more recently, and what we are most concerned with, is the Corps is the primary river manager for the nation at this point in time. And it manages the nation's inland waterway system, so it's in control of maintaining rivers for navigation, of building locks and dams for the navigation system, like the Mississippi River, the Ohio River, the intracoastal waterways. The Corps also constructs flood control projects all across the country, and those have very significant effects on rivers. The Corps also is a regulatory agency, so it regulates the issuance of individual permits for constructing and doing other activities in wetlands. And the Corps also does some restoration work, sometimes good and sometimes not so good. But they have an enormous effect on rivers all across the country, and they are really a major player any place there's a wetland in the country. So as a place where you can try to bring about a real improvement for rivers nationwide, focusing on what the Corps does and trying to change their policies is, we think, a very effective approach.
The Corps has kind of a legacy, really enjoying big projects. Some of these are legendary, but that's kind of what you're starting to want to really, that's what you are addressing in this particular year and in terms of changing policy. Discuss why it is that you feel that the policies need to change. What is it about the Corps and the way that they operate? And they do many good things, but there also are aspects that aren't seem no longer appropriate with our knowledge base and also just the changes that were are occurring. Give us a sense of the types of behaviors and policies that you find particularly dangerous to America's rivers.
Well, the Corps really has, and this, you will hear the environmental community say this, but you will also read these kinds of findings from the National Academy of Sciences and the Army Inspector General, that this Corps has a really strong bias for constructing large-scale, costly projects that are very destructive for natural systems. And this plays itself out kind of over and over again, in part because of the way the Corps evolved over time, but also in part because of the very outdated policies that are in place that drive how the Corps makes decisions with respect to individual projects. They build these projects that are big and bad and destructive, and they tend to want to really focus on large-scale structural solutions that undermine and actually destroy natural systems. And it works against all kinds of important benefits and values for wildlife and for clean water, but it can also put people at risk. And we've seen that particularly and very tragically in New Orleans. And the Corps' role in the flooding of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina passed the city by is really, I think, puts the whole situation in perspective. And the Corps really did play a major role in that, unfortunately, and the consequences have been really devastating to the people in New Orleans and to the rest of the country.
Well, of course, you're very close to the Corps and how they operate, but give the audience a few examples of the types of projects. What is it that they actually do? From their perspective, what they're trying to do is to protect people from floodwaters. You talk about the large-scale projects. Talk about that a bit.
Well, let me go back, I think, and use New Orleans as an example. Even though some of these projects were constructed a while ago, many of them are ongoing, and things really haven't changed. So you can really track this approach in history really through the current-day problems. But the problems in New Orleans are really very far-reaching, obviously. But one of the things that really aggravated the flooding situation in New Orleans in this hurricane season was loss of coastal Louisiana wetlands. Now, the wetlands have been lost for lots of reasons, but in large part due to over-engineering of the Mississippi River by the Corps of Engineers, both to promote navigation and also to providing flood protection to towns along the river. So basically, they've levied the whole river in, and it's shooting, either preventing the sediments from getting into the river that would build the wetlands, or those sediments that do get into the water wind up getting shot way, way out off the coast and can't rebuild. And since the 1930s, the coast of Louisiana has lost about 1,900 square miles of wetlands. Now, every 2.7 miles of linear wetland will reduce a storm surge by 1 foot. Hmm. And they have just lost an enormous amount of those coastal wetlands. That's one way the Corps has played into the situation in New Orleans. The other thing that the Corps has done down New Orleans is actually construct other very destructive projects that have additional wetland losses. One of the most egregious ones, and that we have been fighting now for a long time, is a navigation channel known as the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet. And the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet was conceived of as a shortcut from the Gulf of Mexico to the Mississippi River. For years, local communities have said, you know, this is a hurricane highway, and it will just funnel the storm surge right into our communities. The outlet has also caused the loss of 20,000 acres of coastal wetlands, so those wetlands weren't around to buffer the storm surge. And in fact, during Hurricane Katrina, the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet was shown to have amplified the storm surge, and it shot the storm surge right into St. Bernard Parish in the lower Ninth Ward. And in St. Bernard Parish, only 52 of 28,000 structures remained standing after that storm surge hit. So that had a very real direct effect. The other thing that the Corps did down there, which goes to the really large-scale construction mentality that they have, was when they built the original flood control project, the hurricane protection project in New Orleans, instead of just building levees along the city's edge to really protect the heart of the city, they built the levees out into uninhabited wetlands, very, very far out into the wetlands. They used the increased property value of those drained wetlands to cost justify their project, because the Corps has to actually produce more benefits than costs for each of its projects. And those drained wetlands became the lower Ninth Ward that also flooded very heavily during Katrina. So they actually lured people into harm's way and helped develop that. The other thing, of course, that the Corps did was they used a faulty design and construction in the levees. And the levees and flood walls, many of them that failed because of faulty design and construction. And the Corps actually acknowledged that and admitted that they were at fault in that design. So there's a really dramatic picture of where the agency has gone wrong and how it goes wrong in its plans. Now, there are many places across the country where it's at a smaller scale of problem, but the problems are still the same if the river overflows into your backyard and wipes out your house.
The destruction of wetlands, people hear about this all the time. You're actually talking about a rather interesting concept, and that is the wetlands protecting mainland areas from storm surges. That's a rather unique vision of protection by wetlands. But then let's go upriver to freshwater zones, and let's talk about the importance of wetlands in terms of flood control from a natural perspective. Help us out with that.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. Riverine wetlands and even isolated wetlands are extremely important natural flood protection sources. And an acre of wetland can store 330,000 gallons of water. I mean, they're really important. And that amount of water would actually flood about 13 average-sized homes a site. It's a lot of water that can be held in a wetland and then released more slowly. The other thing that can help really in providing natural flood protection is restoring the natural meander back to a river. And that helps to slow down the velocity of the water and to help store it in the areas. And also, healthy floodplains, even in those areas where they might not be wetlands, just giving the river some room to move around where it doesn't have houses right on top of it can be really very effective ways to provide natural flood protection. And when we talk about natural flood protection, that's really what we mean. Restoring the floodplains, letting the rivers go back to their natural course, and restoring wetlands and natural wetland overflow areas wherever possible. It's clear that in some instances you're still going to need levees. There's no question about that, given the way our communities have, built themselves up. But levees should be the last line of defense against flooding, not the first line. Another really interesting thing that we saw in New Orleans was that those levees that had the least chance of failure and levees that actually stood were ones that had wetland buffers in front of them. Not only do the wetlands help, reduce the flooding level, they also can help protect the structured, engineered protective levees that are on the other side of them.
So really the bottom line is what you're promoting, as you do always, but specifically this year, is trying to help the Corps get back to natural systems for water management as far as rivers are concerned. as you say, restoring the natural course of the rivers, reestablishing the wetlands. Boy, that's a big change. That's a huge change. That's a whole different literal direction for the Corps. But I hope they can figure this one out, because you're absolutely right. These are the things that are leading to disaster, and we just have to wise up. We just plain have to, you know, we are. We are finally figuring this out, and I think the American public even is beginning to say, you know, I think they're beginning to wise up too, and asking harder questions. And maybe that's a good way for us to start to discuss some of the top 10 rivers that are on the list at this point, unless there's something else that you wanted to add about this, you know, in background.
No, I mean, I think that you have summed it up very succinctly. And the reality is that floods are natural events, and we need to work with river systems to let them be natural but not become unnatural disasters. And you can create an unnatural disaster very easily through poor planning, unwise development, and over-reliance on engineering and levees to solve your problems. And it mostly gives people, I think, a very false sense of security.
That term, unnatural disaster, I've never heard that before, but boy, that defines so much of what's going on today, literally around the world. There are a series of unnatural disasters.
And it truly is. These are unnatural disasters. Yeah. The destruction of New Orleans, the flooding of New Orleans, was an unnatural disaster. Hmm. That really didn't have much at all to do with nature, although that was the precipitating factor.
Hmm. Very interesting perspective. Well, let's now talk about some of the rivers. I'm going to go through real fast here and just name some rivers. And if for listeners across the country here in the United States, this is our first real serious international show. The Wildside News is going international. We're excited about that, covering topics all over the world. But let me just read some of these. Some people will go, oh, yeah. The Pajaro River, and this is in California, and we'll talk about that. The northern area of the Yellowstone River, which is I'm very familiar with, having spent quite a bit of time in Yellowstone. The Caloosahatchee River, which is associated with the Everglades. Then, of course, the Willamette River, which is up there in Oregon, which runs right through the city of Portland. The Salmon Trout River in Michigan. The beautiful, beautiful Shenandoah River. Legacy River for America. The Boise River up in those wildlands of Idaho. We also have Bristol Bay watershed in Alaska. The San Jacinto River, which is in Texas, specifically affected by the Houston area, and then the Verde River, which runs through Phoenix. So these are the rivers that are named this year as the top 10 most endangered rivers in America. Well, Melissa, why don't you highlight some of the top 10 rivers and why they're on this list?
Sure. Well, let me start with the Pajaro River in Central California, which is actually our number one most endangered river. And that's on the list because of a proposed Corps of Engineers flood control plan for the lower portion of the river. The river actually has 22 miles of levees along its lower stretch that were built in 1949. And essentially what the Corps wants to do is rebuild those levees. The original project was supposed to provide 50-year flood protection. It now provides, at best, 8 to 25-year flood protection. So it's clearly not working as it had been promised. And the towns along the river, in particular the town of Pajaro, is flooded pretty heavily in both 1995 and 1998. So there's been a lot of problem, a lot of destruction. In 1995, two people were actually killed in the town very sadly from the flooding. And that's prompted a re-examination of the flood control project. But instead of taking a look at the full river system and seeing what's actually causing the problem, the Corps is just proposing to essentially rebuild, with some minor modifications, the same project that hasn't worked for decades. Now, I think it was Albert Einstein who said that insanity was doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. The Corps on the Pajaro really just wants to do the same thing over again. And the citizen activists and American Rivers would like to see the Corps really take a different approach to the river, look at the whole problem upstream and downstream, and utilize natural flood protection to the maximum extent that they can, set the levees as far back as they possibly can where they need to keep them, and really work on reducing the sediment loading and other problems that are actually leading to the flooding in the river.
Now, from what I understand, and this is hard to, I don't understand this, in the press release, for example, about this, it suggests that the problem is being compounded by the fact that they're stripping trees and other vegetation from along the river. Why? Why? I'd like to know, is it for aesthetic purposes, or do you know?
The Corps actually, and the town did at one point, go in and strip virtually all vegetation out of the channel. The concept was that this would help speed water flow through the system and out into Monterey Bay,
right,
where it actually is providing the most polluted water to Monterey Bay from the entire watershed. So that's a problem in and of itself. But the concept was to speed water flow as quickly as possible through the, quote, channel, as opposed to the river, is what the Corps tends to call it. This is the same concept that's led to, quite literally, encasing rivers in concrete.
Right.
Like the Los Angeles River, the concept is to get the water through the system as fast as possible. Now, what's happened, particularly on the Pajaro, is that this has actually increased the velocity of the floodwaters, causing more problems, and it's also increased sedimentation in the river. And the sedimentation is a real problem for the Pajaro, and is part of the reason why there's lots of floods. I mean, the river channel just got clogged up. The river is not in its normal configuration. It's not acting like a natural river. They also have a lot of sedimentation problems upstream, and sand and gravel mining from in the river has changed the channel bed, again, increasing the velocity of the river and increasing the sedimentation. So their approach to addressing the problem actually caused more of a problem.
Now, I noticed that sand and gravel mining seems to be one common theme throughout a number of the top 10 rivers this year. Is this part of the Corps' effort to provide income from these projects to offset the cost by letting out some of these projects, the sand and gravel mining?
Well, the sand and gravel mining actually operates independently of the Corps. Where it's occurring in a river or in a wetland, it does need a permit from the Corps of Engineers, and would also typically need a state permit as well if the state has permitting requirements. So a lot of those are not things that are really wrapped up into the Corps flood control project, but they are part of the problem, and the Corps is part of the problem for allowing these activities, particularly to continue when they're very destructive and ought not to be happening and don't meet the requirements of the Clean Water Act.
So on a positive side, what would you recommend to the Corps?
Well, we'd recommend really taking a look at the entire watershed of the Pajaro, figuring out where you can, in fact, utilize natural flood control. For example, there's wetland areas upstream in the upper watershed that, if restored, could absorb a lot of the flow of the river and help reduce the amount of water coming downstream. The Corps should be setting back where the levees are, setting back the levees as far as possible, reestablishing the natural meander of the river, and helping restore the natural floodplain habitat, and not just keeping the river stripped bare. But they really need to look both upstream and downstream and propose solutions to the real causes of the flooding problem, not just trying to fix it at the very end. And the Corps has the authority to do that. They just don't always like to do that. Because, again, this goes back to their mindset for constructing large structural engineered projects. They want to just build the levees. And the levees would be very expensive, at least $200 million, plus significant maintenance every year.
You're teaching me about things, and that's what this is all about, is to help people learn. I can see we're moving the levees back. What you mean by what my interpretation of that, because I'm a little slow on these things, is to widen the river, in essence, to expand the floodplain, as opposed to narrowing it in between these concreted walls, and therefore to restore, really, the natural flow of the river, which you've stated, but I'm restating it because I'm figuring this out and trying to help better understand
right,
what you're saying.
That's exactly right. It actually, sometimes when you're moving levees back, you can literally be giving the river itself its more natural channel if they've really constricted the river. And oftentimes you're setting it back and allowing the river to just use the floodplain more naturally.
Now, can you talk about the Yellowstone River?
Sure. In the Yellowstone, again, this is in part a Corps of Engineers problem and in part not. Again, these issues can often be very complicated. But on the Yellowstone, it's really a case of people loving the river to death. I mean, it's beautiful up there, and people want to move into the floodplain and be close to the river. But what that's meant is an increasing, you know, everybody who builds a big expensive home along the bank of the river, and then they want to make sure that that river is not eating away their home. And the Upper Yellowstone is a very vibrant river. It moves around. It can eat away at the riverbanks, and it changes course. And so if there's been a very big increase in armoring of the riverbank and really trying to put other hard structures along the bank to prevent the erosion and flooding problems from taking away some, you know, mighty expensive houses that were built. In addition to that, they've cleared the cottonwood forest and the other riparian vegetation, again, to build these very hard structures to try to keep the banks in place. And that's destroyed natural flood protection control and wildlife habitat and, you know, just the general beauty, the very reason the people went up there in the first instance.
I can recall a time when you'd drive through that area and you would see almost no homes. Now there's a home about every, if you're lucky, 20 acres. Mm-hmm. or 40 acres, but they're everywhere. They're just absolutely everywhere. And, of course, river property is prime. But you would think that people would know that those rivers, it's almost like people go in and assume that the river's just going to stay where it is. And it's amazing they don't understand that it's going to move. I've seen some photographs, for example. You do have examples of homes that are falling into rivers. Big expensive homes, rivers, not edges of cliffs that are oceanfront property, but river property, the front yard is going. It's quite extraordinary.
It's really pretty amazing.
People
have to recognize that rivers are vibrant systems, that they move, and that particularly the type of floodplain rivers, the meandering rivers, like the Upper Yellowstone, are going to move. And no matter how much stone or riprap or concrete or how many dikes you put in there to try to control that river, ultimately you're not going to be able to control it.
Yeah, as you say, constructing big barricades to try to, because they have their house there now.
That's right. They have their house there. And, you know, once you have your house there, you can certainly understand that.
I can.
To drive for that, you don't want to lose it, but they ought not to have been put there in the first place. And actually, for the Upper Yellowstone, that's exactly what folks are asking for. They're asking for a comprehensive plan that will take a look at the development and where things should and shouldn't go with respect to construction near the river, so you can stop this from happening up front, because it can really, you can just destroy a river, death by many cuts is basically how that river can get destroyed.
And perhaps there's a few other examples that can point to the complexity of these issues that you'd like to share.
Possibly one of the most complex situations to resolve at this point is the situation on the Caloosahatchee River in Florida. And the problems originally stem from, again, to the core draining of southern Florida and basically destruction of the Everglades, which they're now spending many, many billions of dollars to try to restore. And because of the manipulation of the water through that whole region of the country, water that used to flow into Lake Okeechobee, which was very clean water, is now very polluted water, and they need to reduce the levels of the water lake, so they have these giant pulsing releases out into the Caloosahatchee River and out into the estuary. And those water releases are toxic-laden. They're devastating to both the river and the estuary ecosystem. The call on this river is for the Corps of Engineers to come up with a much better plan to address these necessary water releases from Lake Okeechobee into the river.
Well, what's obviously clear is that these are extremely complex issues, and all the more reason why we have to be thankful that people are taking the time to really press for more fact-based plans for the future, because we're getting a little crowded. Property values are going up, and with the climate change and things, it's hard to know really quite what the changes may be in the future, particularly as it relates to water. Now, here's a question, Melissa, and we're talking with Melissa Samet, who's the Senior Director of Water Resources with American Rivers. Everyone sometimes feels a little helpless, but in this particular case, you're helping them to, you're directing them to take action, and what would you like people to do?
Well, there are two very important steps that you could take. One is to go to our website at www.americanrivers.org, and on the website there is an action alert for each of the rivers listed, and you can take action on one or all 10 of them, which is what we hope that you'll actually do, and really send the message to the decision makers about taking a better approach for each of these rivers. The other thing that would be extremely useful is if your listeners would be willing to call their senators and urge them to pass the Water Resources Planning and Modernization Act of 2006, and the number is S-2288. And that bill would overhaul the Corps' planning process. It would require better planning. It would update the Corps' planning guidelines. So, for example, they weren't allowed to claim project benefits for draining wetlands. It would require independent review of key and important Corps projects. It would require that the Corps actually implement mitigation when it can't avoid impacts to which projects, and it would focus core project planning and construction on national priority needs. And these changes are fundamental to moving this agency with so much control over the nation's rivers into a better organization, and any help that we can get to make that happen would be very much appreciated.
We have links, obviously, as always, to American Rivers on the website, and I actually have the 10 rivers listed that lead to these various special reports on each one of the rivers. Melissa Samet, I want to thank you for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lessons for us all. Now, as promised, we launch the Wild Side News into orbit around the world, gathering news that matters, tracking down the stories that we all share as the world becomes ever more tightly united in a common destiny, tied directly to the state of our lands, our forests, oceans, and air. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council. To everything, turn, turn.